So the next thing I gave you was Ellie Fisher. Some of you may remember Ellie Fisher was an SBM fellow, I think, in the second year of the program. And he came back and spoke here 2 years ago, I think, about, right? So his blog is ADD Rabbi, and also Adarabba, because he spoke about ADD in the Beit Midrash. There's a whole, Ellie and I both wrote articles 4 years, 4 years ago, or the aftermath of earlier scandals, and then after Shana Goldberg's recent piece, each of us rewrote our pieces a number of times, and his is the final piece, which I think is so far the summa of what has been said. And again, mention also has to be made of Paul Shaviv, who really changed the discourse by setting up what he called the Pied Piper teacher as a danger to a school as opposed to as the hero. And it's a really interesting chapter where he sets it out, and it's worth reading. Even if you don't fully agree, it's really worth reading. So Ellie talks about, right, first of all, what charismatic teachers do, but without dealing with the issue of whether teachers always do one or the other, or whether teachers actually move between the categories. Right, he has three categories: what he calls hard charisma, and the last category of what he calls soft charisma. And he acknowledges the definition that I tried to offer there, at the definition of that in the classroom, the one way of figuring out the effects of charisma is whether a charismatic teacher expands the student self or whether a charismatic teacher replaces the student self. Which is an attempt at offering an experiential definition of what happens. And then we both tried to set up a series of boundaries that would enable people who don't have access, because we don't have access to students' experience, right? My claim that I look at that student and they walk out of the classroom and it's clear that those students have less of their own sense of self and more of their teacher's sense of self, how am I going to prove that? So the question is, are there objective markers that you can look for in what teachers do? So the one, which I think is just really important pragmatically, but also important in terms of understanding this, is that most forms of energy are fungible. And so most charismatic teachers, charisma is easily transformable into erotic appeal. And so a very easy test is whether a teacher stretches boundaries in terms of yichud specifically. And that, so I think that in a from school, it's a pretty easy test. If you have a teacher who you recognize as being a charismatic personality, no later than the second, even minor offense, has to be a firing offense. Which does not mean that they're necessarily manipulative. I want to be clear, there are people who are manipulative. It's just because they're human beings, and they put themselves in situations where they're tempted, other people are tempted, eventually they're going to slip. And if they're not self-aware enough to realize this is happening, then you have to get rid of them. Because you're just, right, it's just a scandal waiting to happen. And this can be done. You can walk over to teachers. I've done that. Walk over to teachers and say, may not realize it, but half of your students have your picture on their wall. And often teachers don't realize it. But you have to be aware of it. Right? It has to change the way you react to it. When you react to them. I learned this from there is a novel called, I think, there are two novels I always read together, right? Up the Down Staircase and The Blackboard Jungle. Up the Down Staircase is supposed to be a cheerful novel about teaching in inner city high school. The Blackboard Jungle is supposed to be a hopelessly depressing novel of that sort. But one of the scenes there, is the scene of the teacher who was totally unaware of the impact on the student. And what happens when the student sends a love letter and the teacher corrects the grammar. So I think that's one thing. There's other practical things, but another one, which I think there are two really big things that come out of Ellie's list. One is, what is the ratio of content to unmoored emotion in a teacher's inspirational talks? Can the talks or lessons be quantified in terms of thinking, textual or interpersonal skills, or only or mostly in terms of emotion and inspiration? How does the teacher respond to a student who questions, challenges, or rejects his or her assertions? Now, pragmatically, by the way, it's very, very important not to ask teachers what they do, because many teachers who are the worst at this believe they are the best. Right, that's just the reality that you have to be aware of this. But I think it's an interesting claim. What Eli's basically saying is that people who speak in terms of what I would call, in our initial definition, pure charisma, right, that their arguments are not rooted in any other evaluative system, right, are much more dangerous than people who are accountable to something other than the power of the experience they give you. Right, that's really the difference. You know, I'm cynical about this, I have to say. You know, so I tend to be deeply, deeply cynical about schools who have what they call the ruach person, because I don't know what the Torah is in there. Right? The ruach person is the person who runs the pep rally for the basketball team, and the ruach is the person who runs the pep rally for the Siyah Mishnayas, whatever. Right? You know, the ruach is ruach. There is a value in having an energy person, but I think that Eli's distinction is important. And there we get back. You know, we go back into the Platonic model, right? It means that the charisma has to be answerable to philosophy. It can't be itself, right? It can't be self-justifying. And in the end, right, so he quotes, he goes a fascinating metaphor. He says that God is not in the earthquake, the great gust, or the fire, but in the still small voice. And he does it on purpose because he thinks that the classic biblical, who is taught in the class, in the standard model? We won't redo the Tanakh thing right now. The standard model, right, who is it who's taught that God is not in the earthquake, the great gust, or the fire? Eliyahu HaNavi, right, who is the ultimate charismatic. Eliyahu HaNavi is all about grandiose effects. But I want to finish that by saying, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, in one of his better moments, points out, it's true that God is not in the earthquake and the whirlwind and the fire in Eliyahu, but he is in Iyov. Right, the book of Iyov ends with God answering out of the whirlwind. So whatever lesson Eliyahu learns is not absolute. And Sefer Iyov stands again as the antithesis of the Platonic system, right, in which fiction has its own, right? Fiction charisma has its own standpoint, which is valuable. Okay. So I want to set that out as first of all, as an educational thing, that the claim being that charisma, the capacity to convey some form of inspiration, is simply it's a human capacity. It's really hard for a school to work without people who provide energy. There are schools that just, you know, everyone just does their job and walks in everything, you know, and the content is by itself, but they're very, very rare. And I doubt any whole school can actually do it. I think certain classrooms can function just because of the excitement of the material. But most schools want teachers who are capable of, teachers who are capable of having impact and relationship with students. And that's not a bad thing. It's just you have to set out a system of accountability. Now, you have to not see the fact of inspiration as its own end. But I think the notion that the solution is to get rid of charisma seems to me to be unrealistic. And then I want to argue further. It's not just that. It's that you can have a school which is run entirely by Tosei HaTorah. Right, it's run by Talmidei Chachamim, and at the end of the day, you can say that's brilliant, but nobody knows God. Right, so that's right. So it's not right that there isn't. It's not. I don't think that the halachic system is intended to emulate the Republic. So, is there a way of the things that I have argued? Right. So when we're talking about education. So I'm frank. I'm basically arguing out of my own experience. Right? I haven't quoted the only text I've really quoted at you. One pasuk in Yirmiyah to set up a model which is not dealing with education. And what I basically did was I used Plato to move to claim that philosophy and education are connected. And then I said I used Plato as a straw man to try and argue that we have something different. But I haven't rooted the system that I'm trying to use. Yes.
I was just trying to understand in terms of your 9-point series. teacher is only an effective teacher if he can bring the material to life with charisma? Or is there another dimension to teaching that is more than just the facts and the figures and material, is maybe even non-charismatic, but in some way animates the material, makes it relevant to the student, and that's irrespective of charisma?
So I'm denying the term non-charismatic.
Okay. So
if you can't,
if it's either a rational, reasonable presentation of the facts and the figures and the logic and material and the actual,
right,
or there is a charismatic presentation,
right,
of material, and it's either or.
Right, and we shouldn't confuse charisma with bells and whistles. There are lots of different ways to engage in charisma.
So just to be clear though, it's theoretically possible an effective teacher that's presenting material in terms the student can understand, maybe citing examples from the real world, and the teacher's not very compelling per se otherwise in terms of personality, but is able to.
If the student comes out in love with the material, so the student says, the teacher's boring, I never want to hear them again, but I was really interested by the subject. Great. Not so likely.
So just to be clear, so when you say for a teacher not to be boring, then that implies some aspect of charisma.
Yeah. I don't think I think philosopher kings, right, are unlikely to be able to rule simply because people say, oh, they're very smart. Right, and Plato understands that too. Right, they're going to have to use charisma.
In classical political theory, what validates charisma is bureaucracy. Bureaucratize. If it can't be, then
both. Right, so the first word I ever heard from Lichtenstein, was his question of why. The question was, why did Moshe Rabbeinu have to be the Kohen Gadol initially?
Have to be what?
The Kohen Gadol, right? Why did Moshe Rabbeinu have to be the Kohen Gadol and only Aaron take over afterwards? So he used the concept from sociology, which I think comes from Weber, but I'm never sure if I'm right about that. Called the routinization of charisma. Right, that if you have a bureaucracy which isn't rooted in charisma, then it will become it'll become soul killing. But if you have charisma without bureaucracy, right, that'll run amok. So his theory was the kahuna, right, the kahuna, and the transition of the kahuna from Moshe to Aaron is about the routinization of charisma.
We also see it as a dialogue between Moshe and his father-in-law, who is also a priest and Christ.
Ah, interesting. That's a big question of what you think Kohen means. But it's an interesting reading. That would be like a Leon Cass reading of that episode. Could be. I haven't seen it. He hasn't come out with a Shmot yet, has he? So you can be into it if you read Yisro that way. It's interesting. It's very interesting. Worth exploring. Thank you. Okay, so what I want to say, the question is there sort of concrete evidence in halacha for the type of arguments I'm setting out, or am I just just setting it out? As to say, when I proposed this to the editor, when I proposed the book to Magid, so the response, I said I want to build a political theory out of the sources of halacha, as opposed to imposing, taking a political theory and proving the halacha holds the existing political theory. I was told this was very, very ambitious to try and build a theory actually out of the internal material as opposed to it. So here's what I want to, step one I want to argue. So first of all, we're on page four. You have in Devarim two parshiot, and the parshiot tell you that, first parshiot tells you that if a prophet arises in your midst, or a dreamer, and gives you a sign or wonder, and the sign or wonder which he spoke to you comes true, right? Do not obey the words of that prophet or dreamer, because God is testing you to see whether you really love God. Right? You have to kill that prophet. Right? So false prophets are bad. Prophets of Baal, really, really bad. On the other hand, we learn in Devarim 18, good prophets have to be absolutely obeyed. Absolutely obeyed. As long as they say what they say comes true. So we have prophets who make predictions that come true that are evil and have to be killed, and prophets whose predictions come true and have to be obeyed absolutely, Now, how do we distinguish between those prophets? It's kind of hard, right? Pardon? Wait and see it out. We're waiting. They make the first prediction, right? And it comes true. And then they say, I want you to go eat pork. Now, if they're true prophets, you are absolutely obligated to obey them. And if they are false prophets, you are absolutely obligated to kill them. Now what do you do?
Why didn't we just say that it's the false prophet that says something that counter the halakha, that counter the commandment that is then?
That's great. So we could say, the false prophet is not allowed to tell you to do things that are contra halachic. Unfortunately, so now we'll turn the page. Right, if we'll go to page, page 6, if you want to read it in English. So Maimonides, the Rambam tells you, if you read through this session, right, so if you take a look, in the middle of the second paragraph, there's the three dots, and after the three dots, there's the word likewise. So likewise, a prophet known to us as a prophet, meaning he got one, the Maimonides known to us as a prophet means that he made one prediction which had a less than 50% chance of being true, and he got it right. Okay, right, so let's say beginning of this year he had said the Cleveland Cavaliers will win the NBA championship. Now it's true. So now he is an authorized, right, now he is a verified prophet. Maybe it was not, he could have taken a bigger risk and says I only had a 5% chance as opposed to a 20% chance, but he took his chances, less than 50%. Okay. Likewise, a prophet known to us as a prophet tells us to transgress one of the commandments stated in the Torah, where many commandments, whether severe or light, for a time, it is commanded to obey him. As we have learned from the early sages via tradition, in everything, if the prophet tells you to transgress the words of Torah, like Elijah at Mount Carmel, obey him, except in matters of idolatry. So prophets are not allowed to command you to commit idolatry. But they can command you to do anything else, as long as, right, they cannot claim that the Torah has been changed to do this. They have to say, even though the Torah says this, and it always says this, and will always say this, but you, right now, should not do this.
Well, don't we also have a tradition, for example, that, if it's a kind of something, exigent certain circumstances, like, the fasting and support in the case of,
Yeah, that's Pikuach Nefesh.
Pikuach Nefesh, right?
Yeah, Pikuach Nefesh is part of the law.
Okay, but are you saying this is outside
right. This is Yom Kippur, you're perfectly healthy, and we say to you, Andy Warren, it's time to have that cheeseburger. In front of the whole shul, that's what it needs right now.
That was a problem, and Navi wasn't right?
Well, we'll have to find out, right? This is a risk. How do you know? The classic model, again, is Eliyahu at Mount Carmel, right before he has the scene, because what Eliyahu does is he brings a sacrifice at Mount Carmel. Uh-oh. You're not allowed to do that. There's a temple. And in fact, it has all sorts of dangerous consequences because, at least my theory, I don't think it's a radical thesis, for the rest of Tanakh, even the best kings, what's the thing they never get rid of?
The high places.
The high places. Why? Because anytime they try, somebody says, look over there. That's the altar that Eliyahu HaNavi built. And you were telling me I can't do that? Right? That was the price of Eliyahu HaNavi's charismatic breaking the law. That people never believe that it's against the law anymore.
Except that I think most of the time it's talking about the people didn't kept the high places. It's talking about Yehuda and Mount Carmel was in Israel.
Okay, fair point. Fair point as to what really happens in Israel, where the Israel have any hope of getting rid of that. Right, because they don't have a Beit HaMikdash, right? So they're all worshiping about Azura. But I'm arguing, even in Yehuda, right? They're just looking up there, right? There's a mountain. That's where the altar is. What are you talking? I think, okay. Interesting point, right? It would be cooler if it happened only in Israel and not in Yehuda. It would be cooler. I agree.
But isn't there a difference, though, in terms of when you say that the Navi is, for example, maybe adding a practice or adding a requirement or something for a given situation versus going against Torah in terms of, if Navi were to say, okay, for now, just eat pork. You have to eat pork all the time. Clearly you're going against, something.
But if he says for the next 1,000 years we'll eat pork, that's fine.
Okay. No. I guess there would have to be some sort of overriding rationale for the time.
Ah.
Similar to the case of Eliyahu at the time was afraid that right
then, good.
That he was going to lose the nation.
And who's going to decide whether his argument is good enough? And how? Right, let's suppose.
Well, it wasn't
going to
be that. It wasn't
going to
be that generation.
Here's the case. Right, it's a, you know, one of my favorite cases in responsible literature. I taught it here some years ago. Maybe some of you will remember it. There's a woman, nice, virtuous, you know, middle-class woman, married to a fine, upstanding traveling salesman or international businessman. International businessman goes away. Woman, kindly, open-hearted. Man shows up, wearing a hair shirt. Right, obviously very pious man, asks for shelter. Woman takes him in. Very impressed with the man's piety, he won't eat anything but bread and water, he sleeps on the floor. Every once in a while he does all sorts of things. Obviously he's a tzaddik. Right? This goes on for a week, and at the end, man tells her, by the way, I'm Eliyahu Navi, and the two of us together are fated to be the parents of the Messiah. So you need to sleep with me now, so that we can, right? We can give birth to, right? So that we can together, right? Birth the Messiah. And by the way, don't worry, right? There's a box in my room, and when your husband comes home, right? Don't open the box till your husband comes home. When your husband comes home, you're going to open that box, and you're going to see there's an incredible wealth of jewels inside it that will make you wealthy beyond your wildest dreams. So, she says, okay. Prophet says, you gotta listen. And she sleeps with him. And her husband comes home and she tells him the whole story very excitedly. Look, Eliyahu Navi came and he left this box full of jewels in the room. And then they go to the box and they open the box and unfortunately, no jewels. And then the question comes to the, I forget who it is already now. It's not the Archner. Is it the Archner? Right, whether she's still permitted to her husband or not. Pardon? No, it's not the Rebbe Yehuda. No, it's not the Rebbe Yehuda. I know it's not that. The Rebbe Yehuda is a much wilder, crazy adultery case. It might be the Aruch Liner. It might be that I'm getting something up. But I don't think so. Whatever, I'll find it afterwards. So the question I have is, why is she wrong? I know why she's wrong, because we don't have prophets anymore. But if she had lived in Bayit Rishon, right, if the Shunamit that Elisha lived with, right, that Eliyahu lived with, or the Tzarfatit, right, I forget which one is Eliyahu and Elisha, and that would have been fine, because it doesn't say you don't listen to prophets when they tell you to sleep with you, and it has a really good reason, right? Otherwise, the soul of the Messiah is trapped, and the only way to release the soul of the Messiah is through the union of our the union of our two souls. That's what can release it.
There's also an aspect of, at least with regard to Eliyahu and Har Carmel, there's an aspect of sort of national witness of what's going on. I mean, there's a, this isn't a clandestine operation, it's a very public event.
Okay.
I'm not sure I see what the, especially, I don't know if it's in the Pesukim at all, but you don't see any, what's the personal gain to be gained by the prophet in the case of Eliyahu Har Carmel, aside from...
Okay, so now you're saying all sorts of really interesting critiques. So you're saying that another criteria, not mentioned in the Rambam, is that if a prophet tells you to violate halacha in a way which, right, there's a new rule which is a, what's it called, a conflict of interest rule. Prophets are not allowed to give you instructions that break halacha and are in terms of their own interests. And that will write a whole set of regulations.
But I think in terms of what's just speaking about, again, with the prophet or Carmel or my better instances of this, the command in Devari, right, is it's to the populace.
Uh-huh.
It seems like it's against a prophet making a public declaration on what to do for the entire Kegila. So in other words, there'd be some vetting. Would there not be some vetting? Ostensibly from the greater society, whereas the case of some charlatan making some kind of side deal or making some kind of pushing himself in some white.
Who does the vetting and Since when do you trust people to do good jobs?
There's a chance for some kind of national vetting. If you're in front of 1,000, 10,000 people, somebody's going to call you out if you're off base.
Okay, it's a nice thing, but that person will probably get stoned. The person who calls you out, right? You got the charismatic up there, and you're getting up there saying, right, the prophet's not wearing any clothes. So he says, that man is in violation of Deuteronomy.
Well, he also said prophets that, you know, we got stoned. And Yirmiyahu got stoned.
That's right. And
so, I mean, at least there's a greater chance of some kind of
question. Okay. You can set up a public requirement. Maimonides doesn't, though. It's just funny, the Rambam doesn't set up a requirement that it be public. But they, yeah, so people talk about that, right? But they assisted, so they were over Lifnaver. Right, that's usually the way people, right? They brought the korban out, right? That's how people try and play out, right? How, otherwise, Elio is not a proof at all. But the Rambam uses Elio as the proof. All right, so that's the deal with it. Okay, so I want to set out one possibly uncharacteristically of methodological argument, and you'll see if you buy it. So in the first chapter of Mishnah Sanhedrin, first chapter of Mishnah Sanhedrin is a very complicated, this we're on page 7 now, a very complicated literary phenomenon, because it keeps on listing things and there are with common endings, but breaking them up. Like paragraphish says, right, these three kinds of cases are judged by courts of three, these sets of cases are judged by courts of three, these sets of cases are judged by courts of three. You figure, like, why don't you just have it in one long sentence? Right, so it's difficult to figure out what the literary structure of the opening chapter of Sanhedrin is, because as opposed to having the list of things that are judged by three, the list of things that are judged by courts of 23, the list of things that are judged by courts of 71, it breaks each of them into independent sentences with the same outcome at the end of it. So Rabbi Soloveitchik, in one of his famous shiurim, claims that the breakup of the courts of 71, the reason they're broken into multiple sentences, is because the great Sanhedrin wears multiple hats. And he sets out the types of hats. He says that they serve a role as the symbolic sovereign, and they serve a role as the embodiment of the intellectual tradition, and they serve a role as the high court. And that's right. He says that these three roles of the great Sanhedrin, they symbolize the people, they symbolize the Torah, they head the courts. And so he argues that each of these sections represents one of these roles. I love the idea. It's not always compelling in the evidence, so I cannot tell you that I think it is true, but I love the idea. So I'm going to make an argument of the same sort, which is probably subject to the same vulnerabilities, but we'll see if you buy it. So one of the sections, right, I gave you in Sanhedrin 1:5, you'll see that, right, you see that there are four consecutive statements, each of which end only with, right, only with a only with a court of with the consent of a court of 71. The first is, you cannot judge a tribe, a false prophet, or a high priest except in a court of 71. So what do a tribe, a false prophet, and a high priest have in common? So the first move which the Gemara makes is that a tribe does not actually mean a tribe. Right? A tribe actually means the nasi, right? The head of a tribe. So now the question is, what do these three figures have in common such that they all need to be judged by a tribe of 71? So here's what I wanted to argue. The nasi is, right, the nasi, and this is where I admit I'm making a stretch, because nobody knows this, right? Because we have no tribal political structure, so no one has the faintest idea what Nasi can do other than bring wagonfuls of stuff when you're dedicating the tabernacle, right? That's the only role the Nasi seems to play anywhere in Chumash. But a plausible argument, I think, is that a Nasi within the tribe has roughly the same powers as the king within the nation. So let's assume this really says that you cannot judge the Nasi, meaning you can't judge the king himself, is you can't have in this Mishnah, because the Mishnah is a Second Temple Mishnah when nobody pretended that they had the authority to judge the king. The king would just execute you if you tried to judge him. But in theory, what it really means is that a Sanhedrin should have the authority to judge the king, to judge the high priest, and to judge the prophet. So what is all this about? So I want to suggest that the king, the high priest, and the prophet represent figures who have the authority to break the law. On different grounds, right? So the prophet has what we call hora'at sha'ah, right? The capacity, right, which you just saw, the capacity to tell you to break the law. The king has the right to break the law for public policy purposes, and the high priest has access to the urim v'tumim, which in certain cases seem to be access to a source of authority that does not come from the law. Yes, Ibrahim Achla.
If you're right, there are four categories in that pasuk you like to quote.
Yes.
Why isn't Zaken Mamre in this?
Very good. It's the why Zaken Mamre, right? So we'll talk about that for a moment. So what I want to suggest is that the structure of this Mishnah is that we have four sources of authority, and we legitimate those sources of authority. We have Roim, Kohanim, Nevi'im, and Tofsei HaTorah. And ultimately, what the first Mishnah means is that the other three are ultimately subordinate to the Tofsei HaTorah. Right? That the bearers of the intellectual tradition ultimately have authority over the others. But that this is not intended in a Platonic sense to mean that they're supposed to use their authority to censor everything they do, and that's why the system explicitly gives the prophet the authority, right, the charismatic authority, to say that although they're telling you that on the basis of their authority you should do X, I'm telling you on the basis of my authority to do Y. Now we have a nice bright line rule, which is that whenever the law is always binding, except when a prophet tells you that it's not binding, but when a prophet tells you it's not binding, they are still bound not to tell you that it's permanent, and they're bound not to tell you that it's idolatry, that they can do idolatry, and that's great. But there are the easy test cases, which is what happens if the prophet says do this and it's not idolatry, and the Sanhedrin says yes, it is idolatry. What if he frames it in some kind of way, says only for 1,000 years, that's not permanent, and the Sanhedrin says yes, it is permanent. So ultimately, you're going to have to enable somebody to decide, and also, the way the system is set up, there is this enormous vulnerability, which is that right that the prophet can act out of self-interest, and having gotten one thing right, there should be no control in the prophet's self-interest, except that it doesn't make sense. Right, so I want to argue that the purpose of this Mishnah is to say that while we legitimate charismatic authority, because we recognize that the authority of the law is vulnerable to corruption just like all the others. And that's where Sperm Achla points out that also there are figures, right, that there are critics from within the law, which is the Zaken Mamre. But ultimately, the system says that when push comes to shove, we acknowledge our particular intellectual tradition as having to have authority over the others. Granted that it's not a purely philosophic tradition because it's also rooted in revelation. Right, so the authority of our intellectuals is ultimately rooted in something charismatic as opposed to something human. But we set it up as an ultimate claim, but we set up a system which doesn't assume that because the ultimate authority belongs to the intellectuals, therefore the intellectuals should use it to control the others. Right? All they're supposed to do, right? It's just that there are extreme limits. And then I want to argue, and this will finish with this, is that probably the most popular Gemara that people use nowadays, right, we just taught on Shabbos, is the story of Tanur Shalachnai, and the famous line that everyone loves is Lo Bashamayim Hi, right, Torah is not in heaven, which people often understand as a declaration of human freedom. But I think this is a misunderstanding. It's not a declaration of human freedom from God, it's a recognition that all divine communication ultimately is going to be filtered through a human being. And so we set up a system. We say prophets are entitled to have their role in the system, but the limit that halakha sets up on the law, and this is Maimonides also, that one of the ways in which you can tell that a prophet is a false prophet is if the prophet claims that they know what the law is, not what to do, but they know what the law is. If they violate Lo Bashamayim. So I want to suggest that Lo Bashamayim and Ein Navi Rashai L'Chadesh Davar Me'ata, similar types of things, right? Prophets can't, right? What they are not, they have nothing to do with the historical evolution of law. or about right about human freedom to create the way they wish. What they're about is the restraint of charisma. But if the Torah were still in Shemayim, then that would mean that ultimate authority would have to come. Well, God, right? God told me this, and how could you not listen to it? So it's like saying lo basham, right, saying the Torah is not in heaven, is a way of enabling that the final authority always to be in the hands of the law, as opposed to be in the hands of the charismatics, and that's why Eliezer ultimately has to lose, not because he's wrong, but because procedurally, right, procedurally his claim will mean that charismatics can control the law, rather than the law controlling charismatics, and given it right, and given a choice, even right. So I want to set out, and this is the brother. The political theory of halacha is that charisma is necessary because philosophers are corruptible like everybody else. I mean, it's right. Tosei Torah cannot know you, but it's not. It doesn't set up a system where we just say, okay, we'll let the charismatics and non-charismatics fight it out, and whoever wins wins. It's a system that creates the space for charisma, but also makes clear that in the end, if you have to choose, that the law has right. The law has authority over charisma. The charisma has to be accountable. And then I'm hoping, arguing that that is actually an effective model for thinking about the role of charisma in education as well. Right, that education is that charisma is necessary. Right, we should acknowledge the acknowledge its presence and value of it, but we have to always make sure in the end that charisma is accountable to law. All right, thank you. I apologize again for starting late. So that requires the Paramachla's the conversations Paramachla asks about the authority of the authority of the Zaken, you know, the case of the Zaken Mamre, and I have argued that the Zaken Mamre is on occasion a hero. That you know there is no way ultimately out of reflexive loops, but you can have if an agent makes an error, then you want the Navi to get up and say over and over again they are in error. You don't want the Navi to say this is the law. You want the Navi to get up and over, right? You want the Navi to be telling, show up to members of Sanhedrin and be telling them parables about sheep until they rethink, right? So we want all the criticism imaginable. I think the halachic system, we'll talk about this probably in 2 weeks, I don't know, the halachic system is set up so that there is no restriction on criticism so long as you don't make a claim about what the law is. But then ultimately, right, the question really is, in the end, is there room for a religious concept of civil disobedience? But that goes beyond the scope of tonight's share.
Unfortunately, in the Haredi world, let's restrict that somewhat to the Haredi world of Lakewood and Muncie.
So,
the attitude towards the Adam, the God of Torah, is that they've adopted him because of his career.
So,
he knows what the Torah demands.
So I'm being very clear.
He tells me something. That's
the Enochanami, I'm arguing very, very strongly that we need not to conflate, right, Torah, the authority of intellectual Torah authority with charisma, and that the system breaks down when you say because these people know lots of Torah, therefore they have authority even when they don't justify, right, their pronouncements in terms of Torah or the extreme version of Das Torah. So I am making a fundamental claim against that. You know, you can buy it or not, but yes. I'm directly on point.
Except that when you say that they have to justify it, but the people automatically assume that since he's an Adam Gadol, he
so
is
you know.
Decides what
I'll give this shir over and over again, and eventually they'll listen. That's all I can do, right? If nothing else, because of my overwhelming charisma.